Philadelphia has always meant a very, has always had a very special heart for Slam. Because 10 years ago, in July 4th, we took over the Liberty Bell for the free Mumia Abu-Jamal. And nine years ago that we, you know, were running the streets of Philadelphia, you know, running towards the cops, running away from the cops, various puppet houses, you know, trying to build a movement against the Republican National Convention. And I remember spending about two or three days in the what do you call it, the roundhouse? You know, and they all they fed us was Wawa and cheese sandwiches. And every time I see Wawa, I shut up. So it's always good to be in Philadelphia. It's always good to be in college, and thank you so much. And you know, I have to say right now that I have to admit that I'm doing this lecture under performance enhancing drugs. I had a couple Red Bulls before I got on stage. So all the mistakes are mine. And I just want to say a couple of things. First of all, I have to acknowledge a couple of people in the room, and you know, I want to acknowledge, you know, one of my favorite writers, Dan Berger. I read his Weather Underground book, and he's inspired me in my research on Kwesi Balogun. And last time I was in Philadelphia, I was at the Lava Lounge. What's it called? Lava Space? Lava Lounge? Lava Space? Okay, I don't want to get the thing mixed up. And I gave we did a little program together for his anniversary, what would have been his 60th birthday.
Crazy.
Not mine. Not Dan. I think Dan got his PhD in 13, like when you were 13, 12. I was like, you wrote a book, and you're like, no, I was like, oh, okay. Anyway, I didn't get to see my shit there, but it's such a great to be with him and to be with Susie Subways. You know, me and Susie were in the same organization together. We were in Love and Rage together. You know what I'm saying? And like, and I joined and Love and Rage broke up. But that's, I don't know if that had anything to do with me. But me and Susie were in the same organization together. And I've known her as a writer and as an activist for a number of years. And I see some troublemakers too in the back. And my good friend and comrade for almost 14 years, Jet Brand, I met.
We're going to make them come up and speak in a minute.
They're only speaking, but I have to tell the story of how I met Jed. I met Jed twice. I met Jed one time on the 7th floor of the Communist Party. When I was called upon the 7th floor, and they said, there's a troublemaker in the CUNY movement, and he's running around, he's saying all these things, and this person's name is Jed Brandt. And then I met him again on a bus, because he held up the bus waiting for Chris Day up in Albany when we took buses up to Albany to fight against the budget cuts. He was like, we're not leaving this bus unless we get Chris Day. Then I met him a third time when I took my first semester at Hunter in 1996, when I took Marxism. And I was telling my friend the other day, I was telling him, you know, my first semester at Hunter, I took more philosophy, Marxism, Nietzsche, and I think metaphysics. And I showed it to my parents, my transcript to my parents, and my parents were like, you ain't trying to get no job, are you? And I was like, nope. But now it's kind of funny because I majored in philosophy and I majored in philosophy and black studies and minored in German literature, and now I look at the Brecht form. It's a perfect, you know what I'm saying, for me. So it all works out in the end. Just let your little boss majors know. It all works out. But I met him in a Marxism class that I thought was going to be an A for us, because I just thought we were going to just do like economic theory and just be like, yeah, Marxism is great. But they made us read like Lukács and Marcuse and Adorno. And I remember sending an article to him, and you know, and me and him, and he came out and he said, and he came, I gave him an article on Blacks in the Republican Party, and he smoked a cigarette. And he said, I love that article. And I remember because the smoke never exhaled the smoke. It just kind of stayed there.
It's still there.
You know what I'm saying? It's probably still there. And I'm glad to say because we're both non-smokers now. And John Kim has no idea how much he's influenced me. He's an artist. He's an artist revolutionary. He's a painter. And he's a graphic artist. And his article in Spheric convinced me to come to Hunter. because he talked about breaking with the old left and needed to create something new. And when I read that article, I didn't even know who he was, but I'll say I need to go to Hunter. So John was the one who got me to Hunter. And Lenina, I told her this the other day on her birthday. I met Lenina at the only crazy poetry slam that was like a space like this. It was this place, I don't know if you guys know this place called ABC No Rio, New York? Lower East Side? Yeah, I was there. I know what that is. Yeah. I went into ABC No Rio with this con man named Chicano, big guy. Mm-hmm. Believe me, bigger than me. You know what I'm saying? And like, you know, we were like the titans, you know, the slam board.
Like, always arrested first.
Yeah, always arrested first. You know what I'm saying? We made it hard for the cops, you know. And I remember going downstairs, and the first thing someone came up to me, and I forgot this person's name, but came up to me and was like, give me a hand, we gotta fix the plumbing. And I didn't know what the hell they were talking about. And there was a whole leak that was going on the plumbing. And it was the first time I ever been to an anarchist like live space. You know, and it flipped my head because I was like, wait, you guys own this, but you don't really own it, and you don't pay rent? And I never experienced that before. But I say that to say, because I met Lenina. I remember Lenina because Lenina read poetry that night. It moved me because I was starting to be a poet, and I never knew poetry can be moved in such a way, in such a profound way. And I always remember that, and she always like kind of inspires me with her filmmaking and her poetry. And you know, and I was amazing. That night, it was Lenina, it was Suhail Ahmad, and it was Jorge. And Jorge, like, ripped it. And after that, I was like, you know, I'm studying philosophy. I don't think I can write poetry anymore. And I read poetry on my own time, but that's the thing. But you know, and of course, I can't forget Sasa. She lives in Philadelphia, and I know she's trying to get here tonight, but like, this is actually a picture from my birthday. May 26, 1999, and basically what happened was that I was coming out of the Puerto Rican nationalism class, and they were putting the decision down on open admissions, on remediation, and I came out, and they were like, we got to get down to the Board of Education, Board of Trustees, which is like 12 blocks away from Hunter, and I went down, and me and her went down, and you know, and I decided to meet my this Irish comrade Todd, decided to do a two-person sitting. You know, which is not less strategic then. And they were actually about to hit me. And she jumped out in front of the cops. And she still holds an activist record for getting arrested twice in the same day. She got arrested at an early demonstration. She went to jail with me. And she saved my life and hope to see it someday. This is Sasha. She's a nurse now. You know what I'm saying? So. And I'm glad they're playing Mingus behind me. Asian fight song. I think that's so apropos. My soul looks back and wonder, how did I get over? Let me just see. I'm trying to be all technological and shit. Need some notes for my notebook. But I want to talk a little bit about kind of putting it in together. And I can't ever forget James Ponte, too, my intern from Rec Forum, who's now a freshman at Temple University. He taught a class with George Kasafikas, you know what I'm saying, on the New Left. You know what I'm saying, one of the most brilliant brothers, young brothers I've ever met in my life. I'm always inspired by him. You know what I'm saying, I'm so glad you made it out here tonight. And some of the other people that I see, I recognize, and, you know, and I look forward to talking to you guys later. I don't know where to begin. I just began where I guess I originally decided to begin and talk a little bit about what were some of the historical forces that kind of brought slam, at least brought that historical moment into being. Because I feel like it was similar in a lot of ways to the historical period that we're living in now, because it was really kind of creating something out of people kind of being creative in their own ways to create a movement. And the time that I came with consciousness, you know, 1995, I was 19 years old. I was a student at Westbury. And I knew about the demonstration from a flyer I got all the way out of SUNY Westbury. This is before the internet. I mean, someone that physically got me flyers. And I learned about it out on Long Island. And it felt like I needed to be there. And because the seriousness of it was the fact that at the time, And we didn't really understand at the time what the attacks, what they were doing against CUNY was they were really trying to finally reshape the city and push back all the gains that the people had made in the 60s. So this was a tremendous amount of neoliberal assault upon the people. And they understood in order to remake a city, you need to remake the university. Because the university plays a key role in terms of reproducing the intellectuals in the lifeblood of the city. The university is where your nurses come from. It's where your teachers come from. It's where your doctors and your intellectuals and your writers come from. So you need to have a key sense of reshaping that. And CUNY had been facing a 20-30-year assault attacking it as a failed university, as a university that wasn't working. And so there was a thick propaganda against CUNY. At the same time, they were cutting CUNY, cutting it to the bone, raising tuition. My brother went to Hunter. He paid $600 a semester. This was in the late 80s, early 90s. When I went to Hunter, I think the tuition had gone up to maybe, $1,200, $1,300 a semester. So it was getting out of people's hands. And so we kind of understood that that fight against CUNY was also a tremendous fight and attack against the Black and Latino communities, but also the reshaping of how the city's going to look. Another part of it, too, was that fact that it was also a period historically, globally, where there was a lot of talk about the end of social movements, the end of history. Everyone said that this was the end of the Cold War, and that, you know, that the ideological front is what were gone. And for a while, it felt that way, you know, and because I remember, my mother always told me I had bad timing. So I joined the Young Comics League after the Berlin Wall fell. and it was not a pretty sight. Even though I was excited, it was not a pretty sight. Because the idea, the dominant ideology was that this was the only logical inference to the two world capitalism, and it was also facing with some rollback of this third world movement. But within that context, too, New York City in particular, and I remember, experienced a tremendous amount of resistance. And the resistance came out of several different places. One of the resistance places that came out of was obviously the Lower East Side, where there was a huge squatter movement, in which people actually fought pitched battles in Times Square Park and fought for the right for affordable housing and free housing within the heart of the city. So these three people that rolled over. The second thing that was really interesting was the Black liberation struggle, particularly the struggle against police brutality. The gays are outraged against police brutality, the killing use of Hawkins. And lastly, the direct action of ACT UP kind of played a deep role. But also within CUNY had a deep tradition as well, a tradition of struggle dating back to 1969, the development of Black studies, and also a deep history within 1989, the CUNY takeover over tuition increases. Also added into the mix as well was the fact that as a young person on the left, you felt kind of ideologically and organizationally homeless. And it was kind of a perfect time because it was so funny. It was like one of those things, like a perfect storm. Like Hunter College, in case you don't know, Hunter College is actually located on 68th Street and Lexington Avenue, which is dead set in the middle of Manhattan. So that means you have people all over the city coming to Hunter College. At the same time, within that kind of historical mix, you had a tremendous amount of a homeless left, or at least a homeless left, refugees from the established left, you know, the Communist Party, the Progressive Labor, Revolutionary Communist Party, kind of coming into activism at Hunter, particularly. But at the same time, having this understanding of both, organizing background, but also having this deep critique of top-down, hierarchical ways of looking at the world. Right, so we were developing this horizontal way of looking at the world and really recreating it. Another thing that was really kind of helpful for us was also the development of Zapatistas in 1994. Because internationally, they gave us a different type of model of way to think about organizing. You know, and me and her and Jed, we actually were part of a delegation of people of color to do support work with the Zapatistas. I'm gonna be trying to be real brief and like kind of finish this up right now. But one thing for me that's really kind of good was like the consolidating forces and building powerful facilitative leadership within SLAM. So what does that mean, right? So SLAM comes in, we're able to win student government, 1996, I believe. And that gives us a certain amount of resources to really develop people's organic ability to lead. So what does that mean? What does that mean? So on the personal level, what that meant was that we're able to bring in organizers, we're able to bring in different people like Kylie Mabarro and a lot of other people to bring their experiences into the forefront of organizing work. But it also meant that we always kind of very purposely sought to develop other people's leadership. So, so as a young person at 20, 21, I'm editing a school newspaper with Jed, the Hunter Envoy. And the summer before I edit the school newspaper, I read the book Detroit, I Dream Mine Dying by Dan Korkakis. And I read about how Drum used the Dodge Revolutionary Union Movement, used the school newspaper as a community organizing tool. And I think about that in terms of my organizing work, and I'm able to put some of that into practice in terms of how we edit the newspaper, how we put it out, and it becomes something of a voice throughout the city. That comes out of a sense of both ownership of a particular organization, but also out of a sense of direct facilitative leadership that we were able to facilitate each other's leadership, and also facilitate leadership with people of color, and also demanding people speak and do work. You mentioned Sister Kim Wade. I remember meeting Sister Kim Wade, in a hallway. She just, first day I met her, she dropped a whole bunch of flyers. She was like, all right, you're going to go out to the third floor crosswalk and hand these flyers out and explain to people what the BSU is going to be about. I'm like, all right, I'm good with it. She was like, all right, straight ahead. Went ahead, the way she used to do. Another part of it, too, was really something that Lelina mentioned, was also the sensuality and cultural resistance. And I remember, big part of the scene then was poetry. Because as this political organization's growing, it's also growing aligned with this other spoken word poetry scene. So I remember seeing Saul Williams at Hunter. You guys know who Saul Williams is, right? Ziggy Stardust, Niggy Stardust, or whatever you call it. But I remember before he became Niggy Stardust, he was at Hunter, doing his thing and politically aligned as well, right? It calls into something that Dan talks about too, because I think that a lot of this stuff is part of really rethinking how we look at ideology and how we look at study. Because I think that one of the groups that I'm a part of is called Evolution of Revolution in the 20th Century. And we're actually studying James Lee Boggs' book of the same name. And one of the things that Grace Lee Boggs talks about is the need to create a more human-human. And like create a humanity in which people are able to really express themselves and really come out. And it relates to queerness as well, because in a lot of senses, we were able to come out of a lot of different closets. You know what I'm saying? We were able to come out of closets of not homophobia, but closets of bad relationships. You know what I'm saying? Closets of abusive parent-child relationships. That came out of being a part of a strong movement and literally transforming. My name, my birth name is not Kazembe Balogun. I changed my name 10 years ago to reflect the political commitment and the change of consciousness that occurred that was happening within SLAM and that people taught me. It makes me think about a couple of things, and I really want to kind of bring this up in terms of organization and thinking about study groups and how we build forward. First of all, I mean, I think one thing is that we have to look at our activism as art. You know, Gracie Boggs oftentimes talks about the difference between Kunst and Arbeiter. You know, Kunst is a German word for art, the work of art, and Arbeiter is a physical labor. And oftentimes we have to think about our activist work as creating something out of nothing. And creating art out of our activism work and our creativity. Secondly, I think we have to think about our organizations as temporalities. Someone reminded me one time of this great movie, I'm Not There, the Bob Dylan biopic. And one of the lines that this person reminded me of, I was thinking of, was like, you have to be of your own time. You know what I'm saying? But you also have to be above your time. And that's the trick of terms of organizations, because I think organizations can oftentimes fall into nostalgia and forgetting. Mm-hmm. Direct action. One of the things that made Hallmark Slam really important was this whole time notion of direct action. And when I say direct action against the state. That means actually breaking the rules against the state and challenging their power in a very explicit way and explaining it in a very explicit way. And I think that direct action needs to be prefigurative. You know, constructing, creating a state, but also challenging the state as well. Lastly, I think that we have to think about utopia. Because I think that utopia, thinking about utopia, or as Herbert Marcuse said in Reason and Revolution, you know, the challenge facing us today is really understanding the power of negative thinking. And really understanding that, you know, overcoming the logic of what's in front of us, but actually seeing what's the possibility. So for me, the power of utopia allows us to ask different questions. Here we are faced with the most daunting economic crisis many of us have ever faced before. Many of us know people who do not have jobs, do not have health care, do not have a lot of things. But how does that problem actually allow us to rethink about how we reshape society and how we reshape our organizing work. I think the part of that is really thinking about how we create utopias and how do we create a better society. And not just a better society, but a revolutionary society and liberated humanity. And lastly, I want to say that I really want us to really kind of understand that what I've learned from SLAM is really the opportunity and challenge of now. And I think that it takes a lot of courage. I often sometimes want to write an essay called Direct Action is a Humanism. Because I think that it takes a lot of courage to go against a lot of the things that kind of oppress us on a day-to-day level. But I think that by articulating and putting forward and being courageous and really creating new opportunities, particularly in this particular moment, we can not only challenge the state and challenge the state's power, but we can also create a blueprint of the type of society that we want to live in. Because I think that ultimately, a new revolutionary society is going to require new needs. It's going to require us to rethink about how we consume, how we produce, and how we relate to each other. You know, I don't really want another SUV. You know what I'm saying? I don't have one to begin with. You know what I'm saying? But that's not my idea of a workers' utopia, you know? You know, my idea of what you told me is not having more bananas that are exploited from third world labor. My idea of utopia is actually building equalizing social relationships between people. And actually, but also a part of it too is actually having more free time. You know? So to me, I quote my friend Ashanti Austin. He says, you know, the other times you see a lot of people say jobs, not jails. You have to say, well, you know, a job is a jail. You know what I'm saying? And with the context of utopia, how do we look at this economic crisis? You know what I'm saying? And talk about the potential of liberating some shit. You know? Because it's not an economic crisis for everyone else. A lot of people, this is not an economic crisis. It's business as usual. So I end with that, and I want to say that, you know, I really walk in hope and belief that the empire will fall. And in the words of one of my favorite hip hop artist Medusa. I hope to walk with you today, my hand on my heart and my fist in the air, in building this new revolutionary movement. And I thank you so much.